Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Oh, it's time to start. Yeah. We got to start the show.
Oh, guess we better.
Yeah, let's do it.
All set.
Hey, I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. Thank you for joining us, everybody. It is Monday, June 5th.
Today, we are going to do the news fix and then let you in on what's making us smile. And I'm in LA today, so I'm channeling Kai and using his studio.
Nice.
What's your news today, Amy?
Okay, well, I got a couple. I'll try to keep them both short. The first one I was interested in is a story from Bloomberg Businessweek I saw today. They did a big deep dive on the federal home loan bank system, which I think most people probably hadn't heard of until the sort of March banking madness, maybe still haven't heard of. But these banks were created during the Great Depression to provide private banks with funding to make mortgages. And that was the intent. But, you know, these days, basically, these banks have become a giant backstop for the financial system without actually doing all that much for housing. During the meltdown of several banks in March, we started to learn that, you know, Silvergate, Silicon Valley, Signature, later First Republic, that all failed, had been propped up to varying extents by loans from the Federal Home Loan Bank system to the tune of billions of dollars. But those banks did very little mortgage lending, at least to the average home buyer. This is not taxpayer money, I should say. The banks, the federal home loan banks, make their money by issuing bonds that are exempt from state and local income taxes. Mm-hmm. And they're also attractive to investors because of an assumption that the government would step in case of default. But critics say that allows these banks to rake in huge profits, which they pay out to their member banks and to their executives, but only a fraction of that money actually supports the housing market. Bloomberg's analysis found that these banks brought in $3.2 billion in net income last year. Just $355 million went to a program that supports housing affordability. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Wow. And is there any effort to sort of realign it in any way to make it more helpful for homeowners?
Yeah, I think critics are talking about how we need to reconsider this program. If it's not doing really what it was intended to do, do we need it? On the other hand, it did provide an important backstop, perhaps not enough, but others say the Federal Reserve should be really playing that role, and it does with things like its discount window, where it makes loans to banks that need capital. And this was kind of another way to do that. But I think, you know, stories like this probably will lead to some more thought about how this should be structured. So I just wanted to mention one other one that's, it's just depressing, but it is what it is.
Happy NOAA. Monday.
Yeah, right? I know. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and Scripps Institute of Oceanography said today that the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increased sharply last year from last May to this May. It's now 50% higher than before the industrial era. And this was the fourth largest increase since scientists began taking measurements at the NOAA Observatory on Mauna Loa in Hawaii. And that's, you know, despite all the recent efforts we've seen to transition away from burning fossil fuels, there is some progress there, but obviously we're still moving in the wrong direction. And next year could be even worse. Scientists say that the new El Nino cycle could actually increase the rate of CO2 growth.
Why
so bad
is
news
that?
There. Why is that?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really understand the mechanics of that, but El Nino causes warming of ocean temperatures, ocean surface temperatures, and can lead to drought. Mm. And something about drought leads to more carbon emitted.
Maybe we like run our ACs.
I'd have to dig a little further.
Like anyway, yeah, no, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I should say, I saw this in the Washington Post story, which explained it to some extent, but I came away not fully grasping why that is.
Well, that can be a topic for another day. We can look into it again.
Indeed.
Get somebody to make
what you got
or maybe
today.
Somebody who's listening can make us smart on that.
Please, if you're a climate scientist,
yes,
do tell.
Do tell. So I've got two. So I still subscribe to the paper version of the Washington Post. I know it's like super old school, and yes, I mostly read the paper online, but I do like perusing it, and every single time I actually sit with it, I end up reading a story that I probably would not have clicked on. And that happened
absolutely.
To me this weekend, because there was the front page story of the business section of the Washington Post over the weekend had this story that actually came out, I think, on like May the 26th that I totally missed. But it's this big data analysis of jobs data. And this is so important because this story tells us so much about how we talk about data, especially as it pertains to jobs. And this is going to come up so much as we head into the election cycle. So here's a headline. Why are red states hiring so much faster than blue states? Because these Washington Post reporters and data journalists found a trend that was super clear that Republican-leaning states are hiring faster than blue states. According to this, of the 17 fastest hiring states, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 14 voted for Trump in 2020. The top two Biden voting states, Georgia and Nevada, are probably best classified as purple. The 10 slowest hiring states all went for Biden. Now then, in our political environment, this is easy to be like Republican states and Republican leadership is better for the economy, better for jobs. This is why the hiring is faster. And the numbers do indeed show that the hiring is faster. But when you dig a little bit deeper, it's because the quits rate is also higher. And so it's job turnover that's generating this faster hiring, among some other things. So you have, and this hiring gap has existed even before the pandemic, by the way. It's like a decade or something. So job growth isn't any faster, even though hiring is faster, because people are getting hired. But it's also because they're leaving other jobs. You've got this job turnover. Also, it according to this article, it aligns very closely to people just hopping jobs more often in red states. And the people they talk to attribute that to the fact that red states typically have less union-friendly environments, and union-friendly states tend to have lower job turnover. And also there's some education links that where in states with lower rates of sort of education, people tend to switch jobs more often. Lower wages, people tend to switch jobs more often. And those also align with some of these red state correlations. And it's a super interesting article, really digs into the data. You can make a accurate statement about red states hiring more quickly and miss a big picture of what it tells us about the economy. Now, not to say that there are not good and, you know, reasons that people are hiring in these states. There's a lot of energy jobs in red states and less regulation in those spaces, which means that some of these Fossil fuel and mining intensive industries can really grow in these states a lot easier than elsewhere and therefore add jobs in those spaces. So that is also true. But especially as we head into an election cycle, just be cautious with those data points that people are throwing fast and furious. And it's a super interesting article that I would not have seen if I had not looked at a physical newspaper. So that's
Glad you shared that one. It's fascinating because I clicked on the online version after you shared the link. And if you just read the first couple graphs, you would have a totally different takeaway than if you read the whole story.
Right.
Which shows that faster hiring is not the same as faster job growth. Really interesting.
Which is not really a nuance that I have thought that I think of very often. But yeah. So the other one was something that is actually from today, which is that Oklahoma has approved the first religious charter school in the U.S. that's going to be funded by taxpayers. This is going to be a huge legal fight. Now, there are already some schools in different parts of the country where parents can use state-funded vouchers to send their kids to religious schools, which has also been a fight. But this is a charter school with a religious mandate that will be taxpayer-funded. And it's obviously raising the idea of separation of church and state. It's going to be a big legal fight. The Catholic Archdiocese is like, we are ready to go. Let's settle this once and for all. And I will be very fascinated to see how this this develops over time, because even if and the Supreme Court has seemed to be amenable, or at least the conservatives on the court seem to be amenable to more taxpayer funding going towards religious schools, with the idea that if state funds can be used for private education, you can't discriminate against religious schools, seems to be the direction of the court, as opposed to opponents to these strategies saying you can't use, you know, government money for a religious purpose because separation of church and state. It'll be interesting to see how that ends up, you know, kind of hammering out. But I'll be so fascinated to see what happens in Oklahoma when a Muslim group asks for funds to start a charter school in Oklahoma. I just want to see it.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that'll happen?
I hope if they test the case. I mean, it
yeah.
feels like a natural.
Yeah, or a Jewish school.
Yeah,
or,
exactly. Yeah. It feels like a natural thing. It's like, oh, we're doing this now. Let's do it for everyone. Because that's the thing. If you open this door and say that you have to allow this, you have to allow it for everyone. And if they don't, then that's a whole other can of worms. But yeah, I'm going to be watching this and see how that develops. So those were mine.
Definitely. So before we move on, I went back to the Post story because I wanted to, I didn't want to leave listeners hanging. So here's what this scientist, Ralph Keeling, who's a geochemist at Scripps, told the Post: that El Nino, which is the opposite of La Nina, triggers warmer than normal surface waters in the tropical Pacific Ocean and is marked by drought in some regions. During an El Nino, drying tropical vegetation and savannas contribute to higher CO2 levels.
Ah, because they capture it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he expects the news next year to look even worse.
Yikes. Okay. We really need that smile now.
Absolutely. You go first.
Mine comes courtesy of somebody in the Make Me Smart fan run Discord who posted this super fun New York Times article, which is a profile of Martinus Evans, who has set up this super popular network of runners, and it's called the Slow AF Run Club. You can imagine what AF stands for. And it's a, quote, virtual community of back of the packers with more than 10,000 members worldwide. At 300 pounds, Evans is a beloved figure among runners who have felt left out of the sport. He's graced the cover of Runner's World, posed nude for Men's Health, and appeared in an Adidas ad. His Instagram account, 300 pounds and running, has around 62,000 followers. And this month, he's releasing his first book, Slow AF Run Club, the ultimate guide for anyone who wants to run. And like, I love this because last week, Kai and I were talking about the things that we do to kind of restore ourselves from the barrage of news. And we were talking about how important it is to get outside and do physical activity. And I have real bad knees in my family. And I used to run in like high school, but I ran on like concrete and I feel like I destroyed my knees forever. But I've actually been kind of nervous to get back into running because I'm like, am I a little too heavy now? Is it going to be bad on my knees and this, that, and the other? And I love this. It's inspiring. I want to give it a go.
I love that too. I was like too afraid to read it because I also have an injury that I used to be a runner and I loved running. And I'm afraid that I'm going to go out there and try it again and get disappointed.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the thing, though, right? You're afraid that you're not going to be as good as you were. And I guess if we just let that go and are content to run slow AF, you're
it
still
would be
running.
Pretty slow.
But you're still running, right?
I love
and
it.
I kind of dig that. So that made
totally.
Me smile.
I'm going to read it. That's a good one. So mine comes from the Wall Street Journal's A-Head, which is always a fun, story to read. This one is about how 5-star ratings for services like Uber and Airbnb have become pretty much meaningless because of the pressure to leave
yes.
5 stars, which I'm totally guilty of. Because, you know that these drivers, their living depends on having a good rating. And, I know personally, I'm not going to get in a car with someone who has a low rating, but it's also the way the apps are designed. So the story reports, if you try to leave 4 stars on Lyft, the app asks you what went wrong. So you have to justify mm-hmm. not giving 5 stars. I've totally ended up leaving 5 stars because I didn't want to deal with that. And if drivers have an average below 4.8, they're asked by Lyft to improve their performance. 4.8. I mean, that is pretty good. Like, if that was your grade point average, you'd be really stoked. But I was thinking it's kind of like the standing ovation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm old enough to remember that used to be for exceptional performances. But basically now, if you go to a concert or a play, people stand up and clap no matter what. And you kind of feel like a jerk if you don't, which also makes it kind of like, what do you do for the truly exceptional drivers? I guess you tip them, but it makes it harder to sort like the really excellent from the just fine, okay performance.
Yeah, I've seen people put signs up in the Uber where they're like, please, give a 5-star rating. If my rating drops below X, I'll get kicked off the platform. And it's literally a sign in the car. So there are some services now where they're like rideshare services, but the drivers are staff instead of contractors. And so they actually get paid a wage. And so the ratings don't matter so much there. And I try to use it, but it's a bit more expensive. So I only use it when Uber is surging. But
do you feel like they have more or less motivation to provide good service?
I think more. I mean, they're getting an hourly wage and benefits and time off. I mean, I hope that is the truth, but I don't know. I don't know, honestly.
Yeah. But that's interesting.
I will say though that when I do have a bad experience in a rideshare service, rather than leave fewer stars, I just won't leave any star. Like, I just won't fill out the thing. I'll just skip it.
There you go.
And not leave a tip. Like, that's the worst.
So it sends a message to the person who maybe needs it most.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to knock your rating, but I'm also not going to tip you. So,
yeah. If I get car sick, I'm definitely not giving 5 stars.
Yeah. The issue in D.C. is usually like cars smelling like weed, which is a thing.
Ah! That's coming to more cities very soon.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, that's it for us today. We are going to be back tomorrow with our weekly deep dive. This week, we are going to talk to law professor Stephen Vladeck, author of the new book, The Shadow Docket. And he's going to make us smart about the important Supreme Court decisions that don't normally get so much attention, but definitely end up affecting our lives.
Very much looking forward to that conversation. Until then, if you have a question or a comment or suggestion or want to answer our science question, leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART, or you can email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Today's program was engineered by Jake Cherry, and Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Marissa Cabrera is our senior producer. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. And Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital.
Did you have a good weekend?
Oh, yeah. Only a little less soccer than usual. Summer.
Yay.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.